Hello, everybody. I call the meeting to order. This is the September 10th meeting of the Technical Advisory Committee. Looks like we have a quorum. First item of business is approval of the minutes. Do we have a motion to approve?
So moved, Dan.
Second?
Olson.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries. First up, staff reports. Jason.
Okay, thanks. Financial progress report was attachment 3A, and welcome everybody to a very cool and comfortable Quaker Square. The financial progress report, this is the first one since the end of the last fiscal year, which began July 1st, so this is just 1 month of financial data, but if you look at line 10 at the bottom of the report, you'll see that we've expended 8% of the budget, so that's right where we should be for 1 month into the fiscal year. And things are going well financially. I'd be glad to answer any questions. Otherwise, we would ask for your approval on attachment 3A.
Motion?
Move to approve.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Technical progress report. Curtis.
Thank you. Just a few things to touch on. First, on the federal level. Since the Congress did pass a patch bill that has gone into recess, we haven't really seen anything, including any reaction to the bill that the Senate passed, which was the full, I believe it was a six-year bill, in terms of highway trust funding. The appropriation is due expire in 36 days, as well as the policy in 60 days, so we do expect to hear more of that as we probably get closer to October, which is a great segue into the annual meeting in October. If you're not planning on coming, you should. It's going to be a great event. It's on October 16th. You can register now online on the AMATS website. Speakers will include Deputy Director Alan Beal for District 4 of ODOT, James Hardy from the Southern County Board of Health, and Senator Frank DeRose. So it should be a good agenda, and it will definitely let you all be in attendance. Just a couple other things. You know, what you're going to see today is a lot of us working towards the inputs into the plan. We'll talk a little bit about the pedestrian plan, some demographics, traffic crash report, which gets us on our safety tilt. We're continuing to do those input work. As well as, obviously, we've got the round of funding coming up here soon. A couple other small things, you know, in the May meeting, we had discussed possibly putting together a subcommittee with the policy committee that would look at transportation funding issues. If you recall, I believe it was after TAC in May, we had that large meeting, and we brought that about kind of what were some of the obstacles locally for funding. Then we brought them to the policy committee, and they did express some interest in creating a subcommittee to look at that. My gauged interest so far, I believe only Mr. Joe Paradise has expressed his interest and willingness to sit on the subcommittee. If anyone else is interested in that, we're going to take it to policy again next week, and if they're still interested in it, we might recruit a few people from TAC, forcefully. We'll have Rocco come and break some legs. And then finally, we are looking to reestablish our Connected Communities Planning Grants. We're probably going to be getting the task force together sometime this fall to look at how to reorganize the program, what kind of money is available to do that. So those of you that are on the task force, you'll probably be looking to hear something from me in the future. And if you're not on the task force, we're very interested, please feel free to come see me as we would be happy to appoint additional members as well. With that, if there are any questions.
Thanks, Curtis.
Right, thank you.
The federal funds report, Victor.
Thank you. Fiscal year 2015 ended this past June. Look at the table. We had approximately $16 billion in project expenditures, and we ended up with a balance of about $1.7 million. And that $1.7 million is made up of SEP, TA programs, and CMA 2016, which they did. Looking at fiscal year 2016, well, back to 2015, yeah, so you'll see here in 2015 that the administrative projects did not sell for 2015, we moved to 2016. And then for 2016, if you look at the bottom balance behind the second page, you'll see that we are underfunded by about $700,000. And then also keep in mind, looking back over, that there's a handful of projects that we have a new box in this one in spring when we developed the TSD this past June for this to be approved. Those projects that were moved up, if you add them all up, comes out to about $5 million. So if you add $700,000 into $5 million, we're up here $6 million short. All the projects were moved back in 2016. So the TFP subcommittee, they had a meeting in August. We discuss a lot of issues, which is one of them. What we're going to do is get back together in the middle of the fiscal year, so probably about December, maybe January. Then we'll look to see what's left in 2016, what projects are left to get funded, the funding levels we're at, and we'll see which projects to get funded. And that'll come back to this committee and possibly at that time. What we'll continue to do is to look for trading funds with another FDO in Ohio. As I mentioned before, that's becoming more difficult to do. Ohio FDOs are getting better at spending down their balances in the limit that they do have. They're reserved and trading as well. So as part of that, too, since we are short, the subcommittee also made the decision not to forego the 50% annual increase. Because again, we're short right now as it is, plus any of those other projects we're able to move up, we're still short. And so that would just be for this fiscal year. And then just a couple other little things just to tell you about the CIP. Our copies are up at your couple boxes. There's a table outside of this room here. And then also, there was an email that went out with the PCRs, about complete PCRs. We put them on a map for our area, and that's all. So that's all I have for this item.
Any questions for Victor? All right, thank you. No old business, new business, traffic crash, technical memo. Okay.
Okay, thank you. The 2012-2014 crash report is attachment 5A in your packet. During my presentation, we're going to look at some trends, particularly the last year. We're going to look at some high crash sections and intersections, review the ODOT safety program, and then we're going to look at bicycle and pedestrian safety. In 2014, crashes were up a little bit. We had about 623 more crashes in 14 than we did in 13. What I tried to do was I tried to also graph the thousands of daily vehicle miles traveled to kind of give you a comparison on how it's how it compares with that. And I don't really have any hard evidence of why they increased like they did, other than I think that people are driving a little bit more. The price of gas has come down, and I can't prove this, but possibly the hard winters we've had might have also contributed to it. Injuries increased very low, just 39, less than 1%, so that's good. But the thing to remember is we're still 23%. We're having 23% less crashes now than in 2002. Fatalities have been dropping. That's good news. We went from 44 to 41 to 39. Of course, one fatality is still too many. When we get the data, we have to apply criteria in order to establish the high crash sections and intersections. For sections, the location has to have a minimum of 10 crashes per mile per year and a crash rate of 1. For intersections, it has to have at least 10 crashes in a 3-year period and a minimum crash rate of 1. Then after we come up with the eligible locations, we apply a composite score. A composite score takes into consideration the number of crashes, the crash rate, and the severity index. This is a more balanced way of looking at where a location should be ranked. There were 124 highway sections that met the minimum criteria. The highway sections are table 1 in the report. Briefly looking at the top 5, the first 3 are in Akron. Number 1 was West Exchange Street from Rhodes to Dart, and that's actually this section right here. It's a one-way westbound street, and for some reason there's a lot of crashes in this curving on this side. When you get a little bit further west, that turns into a right-only turn lane, and that has always had a history of a lot of crashes. Fortunately, there is a project plan for Exchange and Cedar, and we're going to reconfigure the highway, so hopefully that will help that section. Number 2 is Manchester Road from Carnegie to Waterloo. In that section, most of the crashes happen near 277, near the interchange. Third was Martin Luther King Boulevard at State Route 59, or the Mirabel from West Market to North Broadway. Fortunately, there's a project plan that should affect that in a positive way. Fourth is in Portage County, Ravenna Township, State Route 14, and 44 is from 59 to State Route 5. There is a project plan for the very north end of that, an intersection project, which might possibly improve things there. And then Howe Avenue, from the Cuyahoga Falls Fork Line to Main Street. And most of those crashes happen near the State Route 8 interchange. There were 275 intersections that met the minimum criteria. Those are table 2 in the report. The first 2 are Akron, Talmadge Avenue and Britton Road was number 1, East Market and Mogador Road, I-76 eastbound exit ramp was number 2. Number 3 was in Springfield Township, 224 and Canton Road, and fortunately there's a project plan there and funding is in place for that. Fourth was Maple and Rhodes in Akron, and fifth was 224 and George Washington Boulevard in Akron. Freeways are analyzed by ODOT. They do it out of their central office. They separate them into rural and urban. They look at 1/10 long sections, and they only consider the top 50 in each category. In our area, we had 6 locations. 2 were on the Ohio Turnpike, and the other 4 are shown on the map on page 3 in the memo. The ODOT safety program is one of the largest in the country. They have award over $100 million for safety projects, and this money can be spent on any roadway. Applications are due April 30th and September 30th in the central office, and they have to be in your district office, which is District 4 or District 3 if you're in Williams County, at least 6 weeks earlier. You can use the money for design, right-of-way, or construction, usually $50,000 to $5 million. And then the local match is usually only 10%. I'm going to just take a moment and talk about the deer crashes. We usually throw animal crashes. We take animal crashes out of the data. We usually don't analyze those because there's really not much we can do to improve a highway to improve crashes with animals. But I did want to mention this because it's a fairly significant number of crashes. There were 2,367 deer crashes reported, and those are just reported. I suspect there was many more that were not reported. And it's about 4% of all the crashes. There were 97 injuries, and the average claim is around $4,000. And the reason I thought this was important to at least mention is the peak season is coming next month. As you can see, October and November are the peak seasons. And I don't know if your community does anything with signs, but I would like to at least raise awareness of this problem in the time of year when it happens. And then at the time of day it happens is 6 in the evening, or 6 in the morning and 6 in the evening are the peak times of day. So I just, there's not much we can do about this, but I just would like to raise awareness of it. And if nothing else, just be careful these next couple months especially. Bike and pedestrian crashes, they have some very unique statistics. First of all, very high percentage of injuries. They're more random and spread out. It's harder to pinpoint specific locations. Many involve children and young people. It's kind of, when you look at these crash reports, you see it's a combination of bike riders, pedestrians, and drivers. Maybe just not being aware of the rules they need to follow. And because of that, I think education is a real good countermeasure to try to curb these types of accidents. The good news is we, in 2014, we had 21 fewer bike crashes and 23 fewer injuries. So that is a positive note. Unfortunately, there were 2 fatalities involving bikes. 339 crashes for the 3-year period, and of course 81% of those involved an injury. I grabbed the age of bike riders involved in these crashes, and there's always been it's always been hard to kind of do age groups. So what I decided to do this year was just grab each age. And as you can see, it kind of peaks right here. Like I call that maybe the pre-driving age. And what I did was I supplied a rolling average trend line to the graph, and it kind of peaks right before the driving age begins. And then for some odd reason, there's a little peak here in the 40s age group. Bicycle crashes happen mostly at intersections, 223 or 66%, 83% or 83 happen at non-intersection locations, and 33 at driveways. This is just an example of a case report. This is what I call the perfect storm. What you have here is you have a bicyclist riding on the sidewalk, and he's riding the wrong direction. And then you have bushes here at this intersection, and then you have a car turning and not pulling out and hitting him. And then after that happens, the car left the scene. So that's a lot of what I see when I start looking at these reports. This could have easily been avoided had the bicyclist been on the proper side of the roadway and possibly just in the lane of traffic. Pedestrian crashes stay fairly steady. Very little change actually between the 3 years. 464 was the total. There were 88% of those crashes involved in injury, and over the 3 years, there were 10 fatalities. And once again, I graphed the age of the pedestrians and applied the rolling average trend line, and as you can see, they kind of peaked a little bit past the driving age. I'm suspecting that could possibly be this 19, 20 age group possibly could involve some college students. I just can't determine that for sure, though. So that and that stays pretty high, and then it drops off out here. But that's slightly different than the biking route. And pedestrian crashes happen basically everywhere, intersections and mid-block and driveways. As you can see, at intersections, most of the time, the vehicle was at fault when the accident happened at the intersection. Many times, the pedestrian was in the crosswalk, the car was turning, and they just didn't see each other. So. Many of these could also be avoided, and I've also seen reports where they think the person getting hit was actually texting. So I think that's not only is that becoming an issue with driving, it's also becoming an issue with pedestrians. And just recently, in the newspaper, in the Beacon Journal, there was an article about people on the towpath bicycling and texting. So texting is affecting safety everywhere. So that pretty much concludes my presentation. Total crashes were up a little bit in 2014. Injuries, fatalities remain about the same. All the locations in the report are eligible for ODOT safety funds. Also, all the locations in the report get points when we score projects for our AMATS funding. And we'll have these locations sorted by community on the website so you can easily look at your own community. AMATS recommends that bicycle and pedestrian facilities and safety be incorporated in any planning you do. Bicycle crashes were down, pedestrian crashes remained about the same. And feel free to contact us if you have any questions about a specific location. And I'd be happy to try to answer any questions now if you have them.
Dave, just one thing. When you were discussing the report, I noticed on the freeway map, I-76 out in Portage County near 14. I think that's the first time I remember at least that location showing up on the freeways. Do we know why that showed up, or did it just kind of barely make it onto the list?
No, I thought that was very odd also because, once again, I don't do those, and I'm not sure why that location came up. I thought that was odd also.
Maybe we'll just follow up with the district a little bit just to see what's going on out there. Thanks.
Yes, Chris.
Dave, do you know how we are, like, top-tier accident rates compared to any other part of the state? Like a similar town, you know, to our population? Are we doing better than maybe our neighbors are? Do we have a sense of that?
I have never actually done like a really in-depth comparison, but I have looked at other MPO's crash reports. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say I think we're doing better. I know that so far 2015 has been a rough year for fatalities, and I'm sure some of you have seen the message boards that the state has programmed to it tells you the number of fatalities up to date, and I kind of checked the number of fatalities that we've had so far in 15, and it didn't look like we had really that type of that type of an increase. I think the state is about 13% higher this year than last year. Of course, this latest crash report didn't include 15, but I'm going to step out on a limb and say I think we're doing a little better than other comparable cities, and I think it's because we do have an awareness of, we do really stress safety, and we have an awareness of safety, and I think that's all paying off. And over the years, we've we've always had a lot of safety projects in the TIP. I know in our new 16-19 TIP, we have $16.5 million of safety money that that we're using towards projects. And ODOT is also doing some major freeway projects that that I think will definitely increase safety.
Questions?
I think a motion is requested.
Before we're accepting the report, is that, do we have a motion to accept the report?
Dave White, so moved.
Second?
I'm awesome.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, motion carries. Thank you, Dave. Krista, draft pedestrian plan.
We've started developing the 2015 pedestrian plan, which is an update to the 2012 plan. It will be a major input into the regional transportation plan. Kind of following on Dave's presentation, safety and how we make places where there aren't pedestrian amenities or where there are only so-so better, increasing connectivity, and then also how do we encourage pedestrian-friendly design are some of the main things we're looking at. One of the things we're really trying to do this year is give really good examples and ways that you can do those three things. We're also updating the sidewalk inventory. So right now we're developing it and continuing to do our analysis. So we're looking for any thoughts, ideas, feedback you have on things that you'd like to see included, or things that you think AMX as an agency should really be looking at or that would be helpful to your communities. Our plan is to send out a draft as soon as possible in the next probably month or so, and then we'd be coming back for approval with a plan in December. So I guess if anyone has any thoughts on what they'd like to see or things that you think we should look at, we'd love to hear them. Or email me at any time after this, too.
Do you have anything to add to that right now? Okay, thanks, Krista.
Thank you.
Curtis, demographic profiles presentation.
Thank you. So recently, the American Community Survey came out with its data through 2013. And one of the things that we try to do is compile some of that demographic data for our transportation planning purposes. We thought maybe that it would be at least interesting to kind of show you some of the things that we've found or some things of how our communities stack up and some of the differences that we've seen. So I'm going to go through with you today about, I believe, 11 maps that kind of show different things, mostly kind of looking at sort of our region and sort of by census tract how things stack up in different areas and sort of what are some of the transportation issues that are also in with that. So first, one of the things that we broke down, this is the population density, people per square mile. And obviously, as you can imagine, Akron, a lot of Akron has some of the highest number of people per square mile. The highest is actually just south of Akron U. About, they have 10,900 people per square mile based on that track. Second highest is Kent in the area around the university, which also has about 9,000 people per square mile based on their track. If you could guess which one is the lowest or some of the lowest are on our range is 72 people per square mile. 72 people is right around there with the Arsenal in that track. Also, about 100 people per square mile is around the National Park, track around the National Park. So I think, here, obviously, I think we have sort of the urban core. Then you see is the population density. The color scale on all these maps is the gray is the lowest, the red is the highest, and it kind of goes through the blues and the greens. It's not the most attractive, but we wanted to at least kind of create that so you could actually see it on the screen. One of the things here with population density, and I'm sure my transit partners would repeat this, is that the lower the density, the harder it is to serve, especially in the outlying areas. But then, too, I think what we've seen is just how great of a difference there is in our region. I mean, you're talking about 100 people per square mile versus 10,000 people per square mile, all within about 25 miles of each other. So we really, as a region, we have everything from the urban all the way through, especially in the southeast Portage County, are still primarily an agricultural area. Next thing we wanted to look at, I guess you could say this is where the cool kids are living. This is the 18 to 24-year-olds where the populations are. If you were going to guess, obviously, I think these areas probably make a whole lot of sense. Again, the Akron U area, Kent State area, and then we see the upticks in even from Hiram. We see that difference, as well as in the Valley, where we have a lot of the apartments and areas that college students also live. Kent is about 89% of the people that live in that block group are between the ages of 18 and 24. Akron U block is about 79%. And then also we see some on the kind of the west side of Akron, a little bit younger, which is between 17 and 30%. The lowest area of where young people are not residing, I guess, which is less than 2%, is in Norton, in this block right here, as well as a chunk of Cuyahoga Falls, actually. Only about 2% of the residents are actually between the ages of 18 and 24. And obviously, too, you see that throughout the suburbs, a similar theme is that the, the range is, it's between that the gray 2% to about 16% is the lightest blue. And I think here, and Dave brought up some of these interesting issues that I think we've thought about. One is that it seems like in the university areas, you're more likely to have some transit dependence, less dependence on the vehicle. But also, you're also talking about the insurance age group that is probably at the highest risk. That's where they're all residing. Not sure what the correlation there is between our traffic crashes. Dave and I were talking about that yesterday. Between that, with distracted driving, things like that, these areas definitely have a much higher percentage of young people than any of the other areas in our region. Now kind of flipping the coin to the over 65 age, and obviously I think even probably in 1950 the perception of 65-year-old versus now is very different. Most 65-year-olds I know are still working, driving, in good health, etc. So it's hard to infer as much about, we're not talking about a completely geriatric class. It's more of I think as people get older. But it's very interesting to me. I think one of the things sometimes I think the perception is that a high percentage of population over 65 are living in the urban area, more like the grandma that lives in North Hill that hasn't moved and she's 85. When what we're seeing now is a big bulk of the percentage of age 65 or over, or the highest percentage, are actually in the suburbs. 26% of the people in town this year in that red block are over 65. As well as in West Akron in the Fairlawn Heights neighborhood, it's the same thing. You have a lot of over 65 retiree or getting ready to retire, similar to Franklin, and less of that in the areas, obviously around the university, but around the downtowns, and also in the rural area, we have less of that. So it's sort of, I think, a little bit different in terms of what we're seeing now is kind of for that first few generations that have basically moved to the suburbs out of college and stayed there. We're getting to the point now where that's where we're seeing a lot of the 65 and older. And again, going back to the transit issue is probably the easiest one to point to in this, is that as that age population continues to age, there's going to be a demand for services, for transportation, and we are not, when we think about what we saw in the density maps, these do not really do great when you're talking about on-demand services and trying to get people to doctor's appointments, et cetera. So this is sort of an interesting trend, I think, that we'll be keeping an eye on, and does have quite a few transportation ramifications. Another one that we look at, especially when we're looking at things like civil protections and equality and things like that, is the minority population or non-white population. Pretty centralized here in the western side of Akron. A couple of the tracks here are in the 98% minority. But we also in Twinsburg have a track up there that's 43% minority. And so here we have kind of the similar issues where in some areas around, I believe in New Franklin, Southeast Portage County, the number of minorities is actually less than 1%, or pretty much statistically zero. So again, it's sort of interesting is that we have wide swaths that we would call less diverse, but we do have some communities in the north that are more diverse, and even some of our suburbs, I think, are a lot more diverse than, say, the more rural area, and especially in our areas of Wayne County, which do also have a low number of minority. But again, typically minorities are usually, typically you'll see more minorities below the poverty level, also minorities who rely on more public transit. So again, this is kind of concerning up here, is that this is a very difficult area for a Summit County Transit Agency to serve. Average household size is sort of interesting from the standpoint of sort of the narrative that I'm sure a lot of you have heard, is that just in general in the United States, household size is getting smaller. It's getting smaller pretty substantially. Back in 1960, the household size in the United States was about 3.3 people per household. Now it's about 2.54. So it's almost dropped an entire person in terms of households. And granted, there are also a lot more households than there used to be, because there's more, because of divorce, there's less two-parent families, single parents with kids, et cetera. Also shrinks the household size, but we see a lot more of them. Some of the interesting things here that we have to consider, and in our scale, the gray is down to about 1.71 people per household. So you see that in areas of Akron, in the Valley. Again, apartments sometimes pop up like that, single people. But we also have our largest is at 3.25 people per household, and that's really anything that's in that orange that you'll see. So larger households in Hudson, larger households in general in a more rural area of Portage County, and as well as some near Akron U. And what was sort of an interesting phenomenon is that in Kent, when you look at the tracks for the universities, the household population is pretty low. It's in the ones, but in the University of Akron, that lap that's just south of the district actually has one of the highest people per household. And we think that's because in Akron, we've got a lot of condensed housing where kids are living, 4 to 6 people in a house. And this tract of Kent, I believe, is mostly dorms and apartments, which would lead to. So you can't make that assumption necessarily that because it's a university, it's going to be smaller households. So what we're seeing in Akron is that we actually have some of the largest households that are right next to the university. From a transportation standpoint, one of the things that we've discussed is just that you have more households and you have smaller households, means usually more trips, so also probably means more cars. So that as we continue to kind of get smaller and smaller households, we're going to continue to see, I think, car usage increase, go up a little bit. And then we could assume, too, that areas that have higher households would take more trips as well. And then kind of bouncing onto that into sort of percent of households with children, what we see a lot of is that there's some really high percentages here. Hudson, a lot of Hudson is between, it's about 49% of households have children. Richfield is similar, with about 38%. And then Stowe also has about 40% children. And you see sort of, you start to see in some of these maps, a concentration of that more on the north side, including Bath and Copley, and a little bit less on the southern tier, not quite as high. So about the highest percentage we have is about 50% of the households. The lowest percentage, the gray, is about 13% or less of the households. And again, some of those areas like the universities, as well as the Valley with apartments ranked pretty low on that account. And sort of what's also interesting to point out is that this in the southern part of Akron near Air Dock is also one of the highest, and it's definitely more of an area where there's a lot of projects and apartments. Whereas, so it's sort of interesting to see that we've got areas that would be considered sort of the more wealthy districts and areas of poorest, but it doesn't really have that correlation. You kind of can have large households in both. And we see that sort of reflected in this map. Which is then sort of interesting when we go to the per capita. I'm going to talk about this one next, actually, so I might go back. We look at percent rented occupied housing units. Again, we see some similar trends with public housing as well as with downtown Akron with the newer housing, as well as if many of you are familiar with the interchange on Steele's Corners. We have quite a few apartments off of there and in the city around Kent, some in Ravenna, so those tend to be higher. The highest percent is about 70-some percent, and you know, obviously in the suburban area, we still mostly have owner-occupied units. So that seems to be the same. There are some areas of rentals that are a little bit higher, but not nearly as many as in the more urban areas, in the areas of the universities. Percent holding a bachelor's degree or higher. This one is interesting. Here we have sort of the powerhouse areas of Hudson has about, on some of their tracks, they have 78% of households or 78% of the population are holding bachelor's degrees or higher. In Copley and Bath, it's about 63%. And then you see, too, here in Southeast, and kind of, again, there's that sort of that north-south line, is that it seems like it's not quite as high as your south of Akron, a little bit higher in the north, and then Portage County, obviously. You know, here we see a lot of that, I think, influx of people from the Cleveland area. Also, but it seems like it's very concentrated on the north side, more so than on the south. Some of the areas that are really low are some of the blocks in Akron, obviously, and then Rittman actually has less than 5% of the population holding a bachelor's degree. So that also is sort of across the board. And if we look at median household income, this kind of shows a different story, is that while you're looking at bachelor's degrees on the last slide, which we're going back, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with income. If you go, you know, if we look at Southeast Portage County and the southern part of the county as a whole, when you look over at the median household income, what you see is that regardless of having a bachelor's degree or not, most of these tracks are actually in a higher income than the median. The median income in our area per track is about $50,150 in income. And so everything that's really that light blue and darker is all higher than the median income of the region. So what you see there, I think, is that that the income levels in our area, especially in the southern, are not necessarily reflective of the bachelor's degrees and don't correlate to income as well. And then, I guess, going back to this per capita income, shows a slightly different story if you think about when we looked at the household size. So obviously, if you've got a larger household, your per capita income is going to be lower. So while we saw in Southeast Portage that their incomes, in a median income, looked healthier, when you also add in the per capita, what you see is that the incomes actually go down a little bit. The median for the region is $24,000 per capita. Hudson is as high as about $68,000 per capita. And what's really pretty incredible about that is that it's also got one of the highest household sizes. That track has the 3.2 households, but they also have the highest income. So you can kind of see the concentration of wealth, especially in northern Hudson. You also see a little bit of that in Bath, is there very high as well, closer to 40-some thousand per capita income. I guess the areas, too, that you would assume are fairly low are the universities. Not a lot of people in the household, but also not a lot of people with a whole lot of money as they are college students. And the last one that we're going to look at today is the percent of housing units built either in or before 1969. So basically, 59. And so this looks at those percentages. So the red is the higher percentages of homes built before 1960, and the cooler colors are less percentage. Typically, 1960 seems like a good year where you really start to see suburbanization really take hold in our region. And I think this really reflects that quite a bit in terms of density and how homes were built. So here, obviously, in Akron, we have a lot of older homes. Barberton, actually, around Lake Anna, 98% of those homes were built before 1960 in that track right there. Another interesting thing that we found was Lakemoore, and Springfield Township around Lakemoore actually has some of the oldest concentration of homes, of 77%. And then you kind of look, too, and on the flip side of that is sort of where there's less. For example, in Northern Stowe, area around Culls Farm, and the North Road area, only 2% of homes were built before 1960. And the same kind of in this area of Green is about 13%, as well as the Montrose area. I know many people talk about their remembering of Montrose when it was still farmland. That's really been built out here post-1960 in the suburban area. So I think, you know, one of the things that's sort of interesting is kind of, in a way, if you remember our planning grant, our planning areas from Connecting Communities, looking at sort of the higher density versus lower density. This sort of bears that out, sort of the planning when we were still planning on a grid system to when we started to see a little bit more of the suburbanization, less, you know, sidewalks and all the developments, obviously a lower density. So this sort of reflects, I think, some of that and what we see. But it kind of also goes to some of the planning challenges that we're dealing with, especially in trying to retrofit some of those areas. So with that, you know, what we wanted to do here was kind of just show you some of the demographics that we're starting to pull for our plan. You know, these will be considered as part of our long-range plan. All these maps are on our website. If there's anything that you, your planning commission, or your staff would like to delve into deeper, or by tract, or by blocks in your area, let us know, because we can, you know, get pretty specific. Seth Bush is our GIS coordinator. I provided his email if you want to get in touch with him, or you can ask me. But you know, we're continuing to dig into this data. We expect to get, you know, more data as we get closer to the plan. But I think it kind of shows at least a good picture on some issues of where we are demographically as a region. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, or at least try to answer any questions.
Anybody? All right, thanks, Chris. Oh, yes.
One quick question. You looked a lot at Summit County, Georgetown. You looked just on the other side of borders.
We have that ability. In this analysis, we have not gone outside the borders, but that's a very easy thing for us to do, and I suspect that as we get closer to doing the plan, we do a more region-wide analysis of demographics, so we'll see that. Especially tend to look at inflow, outflow, you know, which counties are losing population, gaining population.
Yeah. And Curtis, I was going to add, and I can get this on to Seth, I've worked up some that look at census tracts for basically the Cleveland, Akron, Canton metro area. So I think Joe does have a good point. Maybe in the plan or elsewhere, we might want to include some of those because it, as you mentioned, especially on some of those maps of income and so forth, a lot of the northern part of our region is very much influenced by out-migration from Cuyahoga County, and it would kind of show that that bigger picture.
Anybody else? Thanks, Curtis.
Thank you.
Okay, item 6, approving CMAQ projects. Victor?
Thank you. So the table that's
attachments to the memo of resolution, the list of projects that were submitted this past June for a local solicitation process for the statewide CMAC program. There were 13 projects that were submitted requesting about $27 million. And what the statewide committee is looking to do is still on one fiscal year that was 2021. So much like last year, this is our second round. We took the applications and we scored them using the statewide criteria, and this is the order of the scoring of those projects. So we normally give about $5 million in CMAC funds, and we kind of looked at it that way and just gave a rough guess what the percentage down. Essentially ended up being that we possibly get funding would be that first project, Cleveland Massillon Road and Caroline, Greens Massillon Road and Corpus Square project, and then there might be some leftover funds to purchase one of those CNG buses. So what would happen here is once this prioritized list is approved again by the policy committee next week, we'll send it to that group down in Columbus. We'll start looking at it. And then by the end of the calendar year, should be award approvals. And then in January, we come back to amend those into the TLP. So if anybody has any questions?
Yes. I think number six is placed here. Just for clarification, I'm just going to go down to phase three. Does that make sense?
Number two is phase three, number six is phase two.
It's right in the table, but it's not right in the resolution.
Okay.
When last we met, we kind of talked about that there probably would be roughly about 300,000 more to Florida. We would not fund an entire bus. I just want to say that we need to fund two medical full funding for an entire bus. We can't operate a four shuttle bus. So when we go to the state, we need to fund two medical. It's about 420,000 that we need.
We'll look into that. I guess there's two options there. The first two projects could possibly accept less money. So I don't think it's in the state level. There's not. It is what it is. So.
Yeah, Victor, Parda and I talked real briefly before the meeting, and just to expound on that, yeah, talked about that if it were, say, exactly 300,000, then obviously their decision is either a bus or no bus. So that's what I was going to ask you. You just answered that. If possibly one of the things we could try to do would be maybe to have the first two projects take 50,000 less apiece or thereabouts, and that might provide that funding. Or option two, I guess, which would be better for our region, would be if the committee in Columbus would let us, you know, have like 5.1 million or something like that. But I mentioned that I'd make you aware, so thanks for raising that you'd be aware when you go down there to kind of talk to our counterparts.
I mean, we're not for the no bus option, we're for the bus option, obviously. But, you know, and just to raise a point, one of the other things you handed out last time was, you know, the amount of money that Metro has gotten versus Parta has gotten, you know, there's a big difference. So this helps to, you know, kind of ease that gap a little bit. You know, we did a grant, and we came out above Metro this time, and you know, this is one thing we're going to be able to get additional funding. We're the only one out of course that was accepted. So we'd like to, you know, make that push to get, you know, we get one bus. And I know in the past that, you know, programs that we were asked, the Metro was asked last time to rearrange our programs so that other things do get funded.
I think the first option would be trying to get additional funds out of the state, and then we'll go to option two.
Anything else? Okay, do we have a motion to approve the resolution?
Dave White, so moved. Okay. With appropriate corrections.
Second.
Thanks for that catch. any further discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Aye. Motion carries. And resolution 2015-12 for adopting revised AMAT funding guidelines.
Okay. So this is, you know, the TFP subcommittee was busy at their meeting in August, and this is the last thing that was covered. So usually before we start to amount the funding, we open up our policy and see what changes need to be made. So that's what we're doing now. The first page, and that's the memo, second page, resolution. So the third page we come to is the changes being recommended. And what's attached here is just the specific pages where we change the policies. So under general project eligibility, you see there in red, up until now it's always been understood that the member of AMAS applied for funding. It's never really written in our policy, so we finally put that in there too. Turning to the next page, our service transportation program evaluation criteria. What we did there is just, the criteria is all the same, it's just that we provide some of the pointed structures. And we made them add up to 100 points. And we did that for all of our programs just to make it easier to visualize. If you got 80 points, you have a pretty good chance of getting funded in the past. For SDP, it ended up to 133, so that was kind of an odd number. So we just changed it to all of them added to 100 points. Then going to the next sheet, the Transportation Alternatives Program. This is the more significant changes under eligibility. Past, we have some projects that were submitted, and the policy wasn't always clear on what their project entailed. So we're trying to put in the policy that feasibility study must be included prior to getting the funding award. And then also under upgrade down below there, under the program policies number four, there's a clarification on sidewalks are eligible, but not just to replace the sidewalk that's already there. An upgrade would be a 4-foot sidewalk to like an 8-foot sidewalk. And then turning the page is then the evaluation criteria for the transportation alternative program. This is similar to what we had in the policy already, but the format really is different. So this is just a completely new page. But it does cover many, like I said, the same as similar items we had before. Facilities, project type, logical termini, level of use, plan consistency, and then our fair share criteria. And again, these were done to add up to 100 points. And then the next page is our resurfacing program, and that will essentially just change into 100 points on that program. And then the last page to come to is our flow chart for our project selection process. So if you look at the top, in that first bubble there, update funding, policy procedures, criteria. To the right, that's the August September time frame that we're in. And then on the left, it says what it is, the new funding process, and then as we go down. So once this is approved by the policy committee next week, we'll then start the process of sending out notices that letters of intent, or letters of intent, and I'll probably do it about a month from that point. And then once those come back, we'll evaluate them and send out the applications. Those will be due in about another month, so that the October-November time frame. And then once we get those back, November, December time frame, we'll evaluate them, get together with the TFP subcommittee, and then come back with recommendations in January. So this would be for fiscal years 2021 and 2022. My guess at this point is it'll be summer and range of about $19 million total for those 2 years. questions on the process or the change to the policy?
Victor, it says here preferred alignment conforming to AASHTO standards. That's a pretty high bar to meet at planning level. Can you maybe give me some insight on why we're wanting that?
Basically, the idea is that the alignment that we need to have has to follow the guidelines of like width, shoulder, gravel type, that follows the actual guidelines because our federal rights, or the way ODOT interprets the trails, is that they require funding from us to follow those guys. So that's why it's in there, is so that if somebody does a feasibility study and they design an 8-foot trail, AMAC can't fund it. So that's where that standard comes from. It's, you know, for the preferred alignment, we're still looking for just basically a line on the map that says, okay, there's no major red flags with slope, this and this, and we think we can fit that 14 feet that we need to do a trail approved through the ODOT process.
Yeah, because when I read that, I think that you're looking at horizontal and vertical alignment, not just typical. And that's difficult to get a handle on it at the level that things
right.
I think would.
Right. Yeah, and that's why, you know, in the language, we actually had sent this to the TAC tip afterwards to get more feedback, because what we were looking for was enough that basically when you see the description of, like, the red flag analysis, what we want to know is, are there any major impediments, anything that we need to know about that might not allow this trail to go forward? And so that would include an alignment, but you know, but with consideration of AASHTO. So if that gives you a lot of heartburn, I don't know how we could, you know, change it. But what we really want to make sure is that people are planning trails under the size constraints of what we've got. We're allowed to call.
And Curtis, I think what I hear you saying too is, so we're going to look for conformance with AASHTO on the things that meet ODOT eligibility, but not necessarily every single AASHTO standard, like the two that Chris
right,
mentioned.
We're not asking for someone to put together an elevation of the trail that
right.
shows less than 5% slopes throughout. What we're asking for is a plan that would say, hey, this area is high slopes. It might require some additional planning to put a trail through. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'd maybe just suggest that you soften the word conforming to something else, maybe, so that, I don't know.
Maybe consistent with or something
yeah,
like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, maybe. Or? I don't know the right wordsmithing, but I'm just asking that you think about it, because if you have to conform and you get into the project, you know, I don't know. You got to have a pretty detailed design to know those detailed elements, I think. Sorry, I don't have a suggestion for how to make it better.
Is there any room for flexible changes at this point?
I would think so. I mean, it's really up to the committee, and we'll bring this to policy, so it's not final on the field. But, you know, I want to make sure that we have, I don't know if there's any other comments, too, or anybody else's thoughts on what that wording would be.
Jim has one.
Well, the TAC tip discussed this. There was severe reservations about projects moving forward that could not meet guidelines, and they did not have planning done sufficiently to improve them. I think all that Curtis is asking is that us as agencies do our due diligence, and in some cases look at profile preliminarily to make sure that it can be built and move forward. I know we do that, Hudson does that as well, but before we submit for an application, that if there's an area of severe grade, you study it to see if it can be done. It's not designed, it's not good. survey, but it just could be off of contour maps and elevations. So I think the committee went around, there's a lot of discussion on this, and that's why I went back to the communities. But I think the core thing is that we, as the local public agencies, do our due diligence before we submit the application so that we're not losing projects after they've been awarded.
Somebody want to make a suggestion on alternative wording for that, Chris?
Yeah. How about we add reasonable reasonable assurance of conformance with AASHTO standards?
Reasonable assurance?
Yeah. That the preferred alignment conforms with AASHTO standards. I don't think you're looking for, I think what we're saying here is you're not looking for necessarily a detailed design,
right,
but that somebody looks at it at a high enough level that, hey, we feel that it could work. Is that what I'm, maybe that makes me feel better, I don't know. How's that sound to you?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
Jim, I wasn't at that meeting, so with one that was discussed. Does that sound like the reason?
Yeah, that's based on form is what we're looking for. Let's not forget the fact that there are design exceptions to bike trails too. So we're not saying you have to have it exactly, but you should have looked at the major facets.
Okay.
So if the committee wants to make that change, we'll change it to something like, I'll just play it back for you for a second, reasonable assurance that the preferred alignment conforms to AASHTO standards.
Yeah, that's acceptable.
I'd make a motion.
Okay. Second. Any other discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Aye. Motion carries. Thank you, Victor. All right. Jeff, approving fiscal year 2015 completion report.
Memo discussing the staff budgeting expenditures for the fiscal year that just ended on June 30th. The purpose of the attached resolution is to approve the fiscal year 2015 year-end completion report for TransUnion and ODOT for their review. We do this annually, and then we meet with ODOT in October to finalize the fiscal year. And attachment 6C is the financial summary for all the work elements scheduled during last fiscal year in summary. The staff budget was approximately $1.6 million, with nearly that amount expended. The remainder, $16,400, is available for this fiscal year's use through December 31st. A number of significant product activities were accomplished during the last fiscal year, such as the allocation and management of federal funds, the development of the new FY 2016-2019 CIP, the traffic counting program, the high crash location report, participation in the statewide CMAC program, a mid-block pedestrian crossing analysis, a road diet analysis, and preliminary work on the upcoming 2040 Regional Transportation Plan. All planning work for fiscal year 2015 was completed, and expenditures were within the budgeted amounts. Staff recommends approval of resolution 2015-13.
Are there any questions? No questions. Do I have a motion?
Dave White, move to approve.
Second. Third. Any other discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Motion carries. Thank you. Resolution 2015-14 day for approving amendment 1 to the TIP.
Thank you. Resolution 2015-14 is amendment number 1 to our new 2016-19 TIP. This resolution adds six new projects and revises the funding to two projects. The new projects are State Route 225 resurfacing in Deerfield Township with construction in 2016, the high-level State Route 8 bridge engineering, scheduled in fiscal year 2017. The I-76-77 Broadway, Main Broadway Interchange building demolition, scheduled in 2016. State Route 303 resurfacing, scheduled in 2016. And I-480 sound wall in, an I-480 resurfacing in Macedonia, Twinsburg, and Twinsburg Township. And also an I-480 noise wall. Construction scheduled in 2018. And the funding is to be revised to the Streetsboro signal upgrade and the State Route 59 Akron Interbelt rerouting project. The admin staff does recommend approval of amendment number one, resolution 2015.
Is that a motion?
Motion.
Second. John, any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, thank you. All right, the last item of business is formation of the 2016 nominating committee. Do I have any volunteers to join me in that? I believe we need two other members. Not that hard. Jim? All right, that would be great. Anybody else?
I will.
And Chris, super. And does anybody else, you might be able to take another, somebody else? Okay, do we need to have a vote on that then?
I think that's sufficient.
All right, great. We'll be in touch. Thanks, guys. Any other business before us? All right, do I have a motion to adjourn? So move, Jeff. Second. Roger. Motion is adjourned. Thank you so much.